Turn in Friday nights from 6 to 7 p.m. for Bread and Roses. This collective has been on air since 1978, making it the longest-running feminist news and public affairs radio show in the country. You can find Bread and Roses on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/breadandroses, or on Facebook at KBOO Bread and Roses Radio. We hope you tune in.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly, media manipulation, and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, good morning and happy 50th anniversary, KBOO. I'm in a great mood this morning because peace is breaking out in Seoul and Pyongyang, and Washington is having fits over it. It's wonderful, wonderful news to wake up to. North and South Korea both seem keen for the North to take part in the 2018 Winter Olympic Games in the South. That's according to BBC's text, and I'm going to read a bit from theirs, and I want you to understand that I'm just going to throw in comments where I feel like it, and I'm going back and forth with, I'll be going back and forth. With this print, you can get, of course, from bbc.co.uk, which will then redirect to bbc.com, which does change the content. And I used to know a Swedish website, which I could do my news you're not supposed to know thing and use that for redirection. And so it would seem that I was pulling up BBC or whatever from Sweden, and then I wouldn't get these little diversions, which I don't like. So I'll find another way. Because that website seems to be gone. But the BBC writes, there are still hurdles to overcome before North Korean skaters can take to the ice in Pyeongchang. And they also write, next week, one day after Kim Jong-un's birthday, there is a very good chance that representatives of North and South Korea's unification departments will meet in the Truth Village in Panmunjom. Their aim will be to discuss whether the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the official name of North Korea, sends a delegation to the 2018 Winter Olympics taking place in February in Pyeongchang, South Korea. While their attendance wouldn't resolve the long-standing crisis on the Korean Peninsula, BBC writes, it would, as both sides have said, be a gesture of peace. But before we start waiting for North Korean athletes, two figure skaters so far, and its VIP delegation, which might include Kim Yo-jong, the younger sister and close aide of the North Korean leader, to appear in Pyeongchang, and before they meet on the 9th of January, the two Koreas will need to participate in a series of careful interactions, and there's much that could yet go wrong. The fact that South Korean President Moon Jae-in even proposed the meeting in response to remarks Kim Jong-un made during his New Year's Day address has sent some analysts into making overwrought and heavy-handed pronouncements. And here they're talking about things like Fox News, which unfortunately resident Rump watches every morning and then tweets about. And if you actually follow the Fox News agenda, you can see how it works. Fox News says something, and the fool tweets about it. Returning to BBC, they're talking about appeasement of the North, of Pyongyang using its potential participation in the Olympics as a way to extract concessions on issues of geostrategic concern and to give voice to a sky is falling perspective that Pyongyang is attempting to drive a wedge in the South Korean-U.S. alliance. So here again, I want to comment that, I have a radical view of that. It's terrible, I know. It's so disloyal, but it's like this. Korea belongs to Koreans. And it's their business. No matter how used we get to imperialism and whether we say the I word or not, it's their country. But anyway, returning to BBC, they write, it's important to note that Mr. Moon's proposal and Mr. Kim's remarks about the Olympics were the result of two secret meetings between the South and North Korean sports officials, which took place in China in late December. The two Koreas, as I was saying, may agree to participate in the Olympics. From the North Korean side, they write, a vice minister of athletics was sent to interact with his South Korean counterparts, who may or may not have been acting on President Moon's instructions. Seoul and Pyongyang appeared to have leveraged the secret contact and a general agreement about sports exchanges to the potential meeting on the 9th of January. Based on this and both leaders' statements, it's clear there's a high degree of enthusiasm for making this happen, and both sides are proceeding cautiously. So what happens next, they write? The first step will be to have telephone conversations to plan the delegation and agenda for next week's meeting. Now, I was saying this is wonderful news because the news that I have been reporting is that the march to war has been increasing in speed and in intensity, and it's terrifying. And as I've said over the past couple of years, this situation is getting much, much worse than it has been since the early 90s, at least. And, of course, we have the statements of General Mattis and of Trump and Nikki Haley all pointing towards Washington's determination to just plain go to war. And they will end up killing a million people doing this sort of thing. So it's wonderful to see that. I think there's some truth to the attitude that North Korea is trying to throw a spanner in the works, but you know, they're trying to throw a spanner in the works of an upcoming war, and that's a good thing. So who cares what their motivation is? If they can stop this, if they can stop a million people getting killed, basically, when you get right down to it. And there's nothing necessary about this second Korean War. But you'd think so. If you watched U.S. media, you'd think that, oh, there's just no choice but to go and do this horrible mass murdering thing. Well, it isn't. And it's really very encouraging. Very encouraging. I guess the point I'm trying to make is because I was really becoming quite convinced that it was inevitable based on all the detail that I could possibly pull up about the situation, and also trying to correct for confirmation bias. Something easy to do when you're searching news items under certain indices, you'll find what you're looking for, so you have to correct for that. But even with that, it was pretty clear to me that there was a terrific threat, a terrible threat, and even U.S. Pundits who have their fingers on the levers of power were saying that there was a 30% or a 50% chance of war, a true horror. And so now we're talking peace instead. This is a wonderful, wonderful thing. So BBC has written on more details about what it takes to for the two parties to get together. And this is another good thing about it, that it is the Koreans getting together, absent other parties, absent the U.S. notably. The BBC writes about Kim Jong-un's motive, saying that some outside analysts think that Pyongyang is using its potential participation in the Winter Olympics as a backdoor to undermine the international community's sanctions and diplomatic efforts intended to stop the DPRK from testing its ballistic missiles and expanding its inventory of nuclear weapons. They write, "This is myopic and misleading. This was arguably a tactic employed under the late DPRK leader Kim Jong-il. But Kim Jong-un is a different leader than his father, and while Kim Jong-un will certainly order the continued drills of its ballistic missiles, he also wishes to see a reduction in tensions between the two Koreas and avoid any unnecessary panic about the next North Korean nuclear crisis. Pyongyang policymakers also labor under no illusions that President Moon can prevent upcoming South Korea-U.S. military exercises." And that's a hell of a statement right there that speaks to the continued imperial subjection of Korea under the U.S. and the U.S. military. But BBC also writes they might ask the South to cancel the exercises, but also understand the reality that these events are planned long in advance and that Seoul does have some input as to what pieces of military equipment end up being deployed. There is also no reason to think that once the DPRK does conduct a missile drill or even test a nuclear device, these things, given the advanced state of the North's weapons of mass destruction program, are a matter of when and not if, that the South Korean government won't upbraid the DPRK or even advocate for additional sanctions at the UN Security Council. Excuse me, but if the North does participate in the Olympics and manages to keep its lines of communications open, this reduces the likelihood of miscalculation on both sides, which could escalate into a military conflict. So that's the BBC's take on it. Now, Fox News, if you're wondering, has chosen to simply take the issue. I think this embarrasses them. This worries them that there might be peace instead of a war. And so they have taken the issue off their front page. If you scroll down from the Fox News website, you'll see that they have put the issue pretty far down and have changed the parameters to say that now they're saying that a year ago, the DPRK, North Korea, had launched a missile and that it had hit one of their own cities. Just on the face of it, I just found that this morning and haven't really looked at the details, but on the face of it, this is highly unlikely. In the first place, Fox News and other U.S. propaganda organs would not miss, and nor would the U.S. military miss the opportunity to give out the information that the North Koreans had made such a boo-boo. It's a huge deal when they launch a missile. If they had launched a missile and it hit one of their cities, well, that would have been a huge deal. And so it's really unlikely that we are only finding about such a thing a year later. It's just propaganda. They're saying that just to irritate the North Koreans and increase the march towards war, which is what Fox News is about, basically an anti-human organization dedicated to sycophancy to power. And Trump is in power, and so they're even more dedicated now than they ever were. Truly disgusting set of anti-journalists, Fox News, and created, of course, by Roger Ailes. And he stated quite clearly at his time that his intention was to undermine the U.S. working class, and he's done a fine job of that. So turning instead to 38 North, they would be the imperialists with kid gloves, the imperialists that aren't necessarily for war, but most certainly are for the tasty, tasty extraction of all of the mineral wealth and cheap labor that could be offered by the destruction of North Korea. They write, with this year's New Year's address, Kim Jong-un put in play a familiar North Korean gambit, letting the fox loose among the chickens. He unveiled policies probably planned and refined over the past several months designed to create room, pardon me, to justify a pause or at least a slowdown in the tempo of activity in the nuclear and missile areas by declaring success in achieving an effective nuclear deterrent, offer the opening for dialogue that the North probably assumes the ROK Blue House had been praying for, and further prepare the population to cope with sanctions over an extended period. Kim went surprisingly easy, they write, on the United States in his speech, compared with the North's routine characterizations of it since earlier this year. He did not accuse the U.S. of posing an existential threat to the North and made no mention of what Pyongyang had earlier portrayed as exceedingly inflammatory, threatening, and insulting remarks by President Trump at the UN General Assembly in September. Kim also soft-pedaled what the North has otherwise portrayed as an accelerating pace of provocative U.S. military exercises throughout the year. Nevertheless, by personalizing his position, asserting that the nuclear button is on my office desk and that the U.S. could not provoke a war against me or our state, Kim made it clear he isn't ready to give up in the spirit of the mano-a-mano confrontation he adopted in his unusually tough response released soon after the U.S. President's UNGA speech. He also didn't mention any conditions for opening talks with the U.S. The silence in the context of the entire speech suggests Pyongyang is going to stay negative towards engaging Washington for now. So you can find more on that at 38 North. So I want to, as I was saying, I may get back to that, but I want to go on to topics. The other topic, the long simmering topic, of course, is climate change. And climate change means storms, and it means extreme weather, and the persons that that affects the most are the homeless population. Yesterday, I was able to get a segment on KBOO News about more than 80 people dying just in Portland on the streets, average age 49. People dying of easily treatable things, a really horrific situation when you think about it, something like 1 in 50 people doomed to die due to the stress of living on the streets just in Portland. And Radio Havana Cuba has an article on it saying the number of homeless people in the United States has increased for the first time since 2010, driven by a surge in the number of people living on the streets in Los Angeles, California, and other West Coast cities, according to a new government study. 554,000 people were homeless across America during a one-night count in January of this year, a nearly 1% increase from 2016. That's according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Of that total, 193,000 people were unsheltered, meaning they had no access to nightly shelter and instead were staying in the streets, tents, vehicles, and other places considered uninhabitable. Increases are higher in several West Coast cities, where the explosion in homelessness has prompted at least 10 city and county governments to declare states of emergency since 2015. Los Angeles and its surrounding suburbs saw their total homeless counts top 55,000 people this year, according to the report, and an increase of more than 13,000 from 2016. Four out of every five homeless individuals there are considered unsheltered, leaving tens of thousands of people with no place to sleep other than the streets or parks. While the overall homeless population in the states of California, Oregon, and Washington grew by 14% over the past 2 years, the part of that population considered unsheltered climbed 23% to 108,000. Many cities on the U.S. West Coast are struggling with acute homelessness amid an unprecedented level of poverty and hardship in the region, a new report suggests. Homeless advocates and local officials say, ironically, that the region's booming economy is the main culprit for the surge in homelessness. A vibrant state economy hasn't translated into quality of life improvement for a lot of Californians. That's according to Sarah Kimberlin, a senior analyst at California Budget and Policy Center. Rents have soared beyond affordability for many low-wage workers. And you know it, if you're listening to me on a battery-powered radio or in your car and you're out on the streets, we know it, we see it, and we are experiencing it. But returning to Radio Havana, Cuba, now even a temporary setback can be enough to leave lower-wage workers out in the streets. Observers say that federal government's response to homelessness is lackluster. Government investment in low-income homes has lagged since it was slashed during the administration of former President Ronald Reagan. A lack of affordable housing combined with falling wages at the lower end of the U.S. pay scale has been cited by analysts as a cause for homelessness in the United States, and that's from Radio Havana, Cuba, edited by Jorge Ruiz Miares. And, of course, what they're really saying, and the reason it's on Radio Havana is part of their propaganda, and their statement would be, capitalism has failed, and they'd be correct. So the weather is all anyone can talk about these days, and this is from earther.com. For good reason, a bomb cyclone is tearing up the East Coast. It's freezing outside, but for poor people who struggle to pay their energy bills, weather like this is more than a nuisance. It can be a life or death situation. More and more often, Americans are getting their electricity cut off, even if it's freezing outside. In a single year ending May 2016, Ohio utilities disconnected more than 314,000 residents from power, 84% than 10 years ago. Pennsylvania saw 220,000 shutoffs in 2015. A disproportionate number of communities facing shutoffs are low-income and or predominantly made up of people of color, according to the report the NAACP released earlier this year. The reason for the shutoffs? Energy isn't cheap. It's especially a heavy burden for families who don't make much money. A household with a median annual income of $25,000 will spend more than 7% of its annual income on energy bills, whereas a household that makes a median annual income of $90,000 spends just 2% on energy costs, according to a 2016 report from the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. Black and Latino households allocate more of their income on energy than their white neighbors. There's really no difference in how African Americans, Latinos, and whites consume energy, but the real issue is in the efficient consumption of that energy. That's according to Tony Reams, assistant professor at University of Michigan, who teaches a class on energy justice. Communities of color tend to live in less energy-efficient housing, which Reams attributes to housing segregation. Renters also have no say over whether their landlord decides to better insulate a building. An absentee landlord has little incentive to weatherize an apartment complex if the utility bill falls on another person's lap. Quoting Reams again, the pervasiveness of the old residential segregation policies that were in place and legal before are really having an impact on people today and the type of housing they can consume. So it's just likely that Latinos and African Americans and other disadvantaged populations are consuming inefficient housing, which results in unaffordable energy. People will spend even more money as this record-breaking weather pushes northeastern power plants to the edge. Some parts of the country are running out of natural gas, forcing grid operators to turn to oil. It's invisible environmental injustice. You can see the power plant polluting the community, but not that 20 houses in your neighborhood are facing shutoffs. The struggle to pay for energy is not only compounded by weather, but by politics. This year, federal assistance for families struggling to pay the utility bills is likely to cease. President Donald Trump has proposed to eliminate the low-income household energy assistance program in the 2018 budget. Incredible, isn't it? So, if you're poor, if you don't have sufficient, Americans don't like to admit that they're poor. It's amazing. People who can't make their utility bills will tell you that they're middle class. That's absurd. We're workers, people. We are workers. You depend on a paycheck, you're a worker. You're working class. Doesn't matter whether your collar is blue or not. Doesn't matter whether you have grease on your hands. And I think it's very important to realize that, to recognize that it's one of those subtle pieces of capitalist propaganda that is so destructive. You're not middle class. Middle class used to mean, it, right now it's just a buzzword, really. I mean, if you get down to it, what is it? It means nothing. It means that you won't admit your situation. And middle class used to mean something like a doctor, say a retired doctor who didn't depend on further income. Or an independent doctor who had, I'm talking about a century ago, who had accumulated enough wealth that could live for 2-3 years without having to see another patient. That's middle class. That's the not the comfort of the upper class, who would never have to work a day. People who were born into millions of dollars, like Trump, or like the Walton family, which parasites, if I may verb that noun, which parasites off the Walmart working class, and are born into billions of dollars. They never have to work. They never will. They are not middle class. They are the rich. And in this country, if you follow the statistics, really about who has, if you follow the statistics and understand who has sufficient money not to have to work, we really don't have a middle class. We have workers and we have the very rich. And that's about it. Because even the people making $160,000, are so bamboozled into the lifestyle of the affluent that they would run out of money within a year if they didn't continue to get their paychecks. An absurd thing, but that's how it is. And if you're making $160,000, you know what I'm saying is true. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, and I've been getting around to climate change by way of talking about homelessness and talking about power cutoffs. And it is a cruel thing indeed to be living on the sidewalk and or to have your access to heat cut off. It does kill. It is killing now. And this is the failure of capitalism. And climate change is also a grotesque failure of capitalism, because climate change is marching forward, increasing, accelerating. From thinkprogress.org, it's been very cold over North America for days. But globally, 2017 has ended up smashing the record for the hottest year on record without an El Niño. And that has scientists worried, since the warmest years usually happen when the long-term human-caused global warming trend gets a short-term burst from El Niño's enhanced warming of the tropical Pacific. The fact is that without global warming, all the natural influences should have made the year cooler than normal, not hotter than normal. That's according to Professor of Thermal Sciences John Abraham, explaining to Think Progress. And speaking for myself, this also includes the fact that the solar radiation, the actual heat production from the sun, is down because of its cycles. So we have a La Niña year instead of El Niño. We have the sun cooling down, and yet the planet grows warmer. This is because, of course, human-induced climate change. Returning to that text, climatologist Michael Mann says in an email that the recent spate of annual temperature records means that not only hasn't global warming slowed down, as the deniers have asserted, quoting him, if anything, it's accelerating as we continue to pump carbon into the atmosphere through the burning of fossil fuels, end quotes. The environmental scientist Dana Nucitelli explained in the UK Guardian Tuesday of this week, for each type of year, La Niña, El Niño, and neutral, the global surface warming trend between 64 and 2017 is 0.17 to 0.18 centigrade per decade, which is consistent with climate model predictions. What's so remarkable about 2017, she notes, is that it crushed the old record for the hottest non-El Niño year. That would be 2014. And 2017 was so hot, it's the second hottest year on record, surpassing even 2015, which had a strong El Niño. The fact that we continue to see records break regardless of the natural conditions mean that we humans have overridden the natural cycle. And quoting the scientist Abraham, once again, the real data creates liars of those who deny climate change, like Trump, end quote. So turning to that commie publication, the New York Times, I'm just kidding. You know, I used to say that commie publication, New York Times, I've been saying that for decades, and it's a laugh line. Well, it doesn't work anymore, because that's the sort of attitude of the fools who are in the White House. That's the attitude they like to project. So I guess I'll just drop that. So quoting that conformist publication, sincerely conformist publication, New York Times, as bitter cold continues to grip much of North America and help spawn the fierce storm along the East Coast, the question arises, what's the influence of climate change? Some scientists studying the connection between climate change and cold spells, which occur when the cold Arctic air dips south, say that they may be related, but the importance of the relationship is not fully clear yet. The Arctic is not as cold as it used to be. The region is warming faster than any other, and studies suggest that this warming is weakening the jet stream, which ordinarily acts as a giant lasso, corralling cold air, say that three times quickly, corralling cold air around the pole. And moving from that article. This is what I was talking about last week. This is something to watch for if you're the sort that, like me, if you're a news junkie and a weather junkie and you like to see what's coming, you can look at the satellite jet stream maps and you can see what's happening, that that the jet stream is just meandering all over the place. And we're going to see more of that, and that is because, evidently, you know, speaking unscientifically aggregating or gestalting my opinion on this based on what the climate scientist has said, it's pretty clear that the excessive warmth, and it really is amazing, the warmth in the North Pole particularly, is pushing these storms all over the place, and this will continue to happen and will worsen. And right now there is a Sandy-like storm happening. If you look at the satellite pictures, of a hurricane-appearing storm is striking the East Coast, and it's a snowstorm. So we'll be hearing more about that this week. And this is a global warming phenomenon. Returning to the article, there's a lot of agreement that the Arctic plays a role. It's just not known exactly how much. Skipping ahead, the reason a direct connection between cold weather and global warming is still up for debate, scientists say, is that there are many other factors involved: ocean temperatures in the tropics, soil moisture, snow cover, even the long-term natural variability of large ocean systems, all can influence the jet stream. Now, that article is kind of typical for the New York Times in that they're being very cautious. And you can find plenty of caution if you poke around scientists, because that's the nature of science. I was talking earlier about confirmation bias. That's what they're trying to avoid. And so this was a hedging paragraph from the New York Times. But if you get down further into the text, into the meat of it, you find statements like Rick Tauman, climate service managers with the National Weather Service in Fairbanks, quote, "I think everyone would agree that potentially the warming Arctic could have impacts on the lower latitudes," end quotes. And skipping ahead and also quoting the New York Times article, "Much of the Northern Hemisphere is cold this time of year. It's winter after all. Cold snaps have occurred throughout history, certainly long before industrialization resulted in large emissions of greenhouse gases. And as with any single weather event, it's difficult to directly attribute the influence of climate change to a particular cold spell, but scientists have been puzzled." It's, you know, follow the "but." "But scientists have been puzzled by data that at first seems counterintuitive. Despite an undeniable overall year-round warming trend, winters in North America and Europe have trended cooler over the past quarter century." And then you have to skip ahead to get right down to the nitty-gritty, which is, ordinarily, they write, "the jet stream is straight blowing from west to east. When it becomes weaker, it can become wavy, more like a big snake around the northern hemisphere." It looks like, speaking for myself, it looks like the track of a drunk. So there you have it. I finally got around to climate change, though not to all of the text that I wanted to get to today. So I urge you to turn to scientificamerican.com. There's an article by Chelsea Harvey. It's rather lengthy, but I think it's worth your time. Chelsea Harvey, pardon me, writes, "As the potential effects of climate change are seen around the world, from starving polar bears to record-breaking storms, interest in climate science is soaring. Scientists are digging into the how, why, and what's next of global temperatures, melting ice, emission sources and sinks, changing weather patterns, and rising seas. This last year has seen major breakthroughs and advancements in climate research." And here are some of the biggest findings, and then I don't have time to present them all to you. But just the first couple, in January, both NOAA and NASA confirmed that 2016 was the hottest year ever recorded. 2 months later, in March, NOAA scientists announced that atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations are climbing at a record pace for the second year in a row. At the end of 2017, scientists expected that it would not break 2016's record. But as I was saying earlier, it is the second warmest and is the warmest without an El Nino phenomenon. And skipping ahead, Scientists observed record low sea ice, and I want to lay these numbers on you. Something like 815,000 square miles of sea ice coverage, and that is down incredibly from the average over the last 20 years. So the sea ice is disappearing at a terrifically rapid pace. And the takeaway is it is driving the storms. There is such a storm right now on the East Coast. We have a jackass president trying to pretend that we need more global warming. That's exactly the opposite of what we need right now. You've been listening to Press Watch. Coming up, Per Fagring's about to come into the studio and do Fight the Empire. So you'll want to stay tuned for that. To KBOO at 90.7 FM and other frequencies in Cascadia and via KBOO.FM to you and to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Rocker T and the 7th Street Band on Saturday, January 6th, beginning at 9 p.m. at Mississippi Studios in Portland. Rocker T is from Brooklyn and has 7 albums released by a number of labels playing reggae and a reggaeton. Also performing will be local artist Aaron Nigel Smith, Heavy City, and DJ Kansaman. Again, that's Rocker T and the 7th Street Band on Saturday, January 6th, 9 p.m. at Mississippi Studios, 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.